Everyone, namaste. Welcome back to Anthropause. I am Satashma.
I am Simone, and thank you for joining us for our 10th episode, which is a short review of the COP26.
We have Ms. Bindu Bhandari, a climate change campaigner turned communicator from Nepal, who attended the United Nations Climate Change Conference held in Glasgow this past month.
Ms. Bhandari currently works for a think tank called Climate Interactive. Her work focuses on using interactive climate tools to deliver system insights that are policy relevant for mitigating climate change with equitable policies.
Welcome to the show, Ms. Bhandari. We are very excited to speak with you.
So to begin with, we wanted to ask you, what is COP26 and why is the summit important?
Thank you so much, Simona and Sipasma, for having me here and happy to share my thoughts on COP26 overall. But to get started on what actually COP26 is, so COP stands for Conference of Parties. So this is the 26th time that these parties are meeting, so it's called COP26. And by parties, what it means is back in 1992, there was this environmental treaty signed by around 154 countries at that time, but was later joined by other countries. And the main goal of that treaty was to avoid the harmful interference of human beings on the Earth system, Earth's climate system. So after that treaty was adopted, and then beginning on 1995, every year, these countries or the blocs which have ratified that convention are known as parties. And this is the 26th time they are meeting. So it's called 26th Conference of Parties. Just to add to the next question of why it is important, because it is the formal process in which countries which initially agreed after knowing that we human beings are the reason for this global warming. So these countries have gone into several phases of discussions and finally to kind of concretize all those discussions that happened throughout the year, but to actually bring it into the table and have this formal process of finalizing the decision. This is seen as very crucial, and this is being yearly. I think it also gives chances for the countries to kind of come up with new ideas for implementation, but also for the governance of all these ideas and to keep themselves updated with what the science is telling about climate change. So given that, it's really important.
So our second question is, what was the COP26 summit supposed to accomplish, and what did it accomplish?
Sure. So talking about COP26, we can see it through what's the overarching goal of the summit was, but also in terms of technicalities, what the negotiation, the formal discussion actually accomplished during the 2 weeks from 1st of November to the 13th of November when it was held here in Glasgow in the UK, where I'm currently based. So COP26, the main overarching goal was to limit the global rise of temperature to well below 2 degrees Celsius. And especially at this COP, parties were really focusing on making it more ambitious and limiting the temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius. So that was the overall goal. But to break it down into several other components which were discussed upon, the COP presidency, UK presidency, who was kind of facilitating the entire process for the last 2 years, had 4 different elements that was discussed. So the elements regarding to mitigation, how we cut down our greenhouse gas emissions to cut that path towards 1.5. The next was about adaptation, how to support countries which are lying in the front line of climate crisis, but do not have all the support that they need to tackle with the impacts that are already there. The next is about finance. Again, supporting the countries, developing and least developed countries, which need these resources in order to adapt to the changes around them. And the next element, especially this was pushed forward by the UK COP presidency, was very interesting around collaboration, how countries, not just the countries, but different alliances and different coalitions come together to meet all these 3 goals that were discussed before. So the main idea, the main ambition of COP26 was to deliver on the Paris Agreement. Again, the goal was to limit the global rise of temperature to well below 2 degrees Celsius. But the nitty-gritty of it lied around 4 themes: mitigation, adaptation, finance, and collaboration.
Thank you for putting that in so well. We will go into each of these later in our conversation. But talking about mitigation, what were some of the perspectives and promises made by the top emitting nations at the summit this year?
Yeah, sure. So regarding mitigation, again, inside the COP, there is this formal negotiation where decision and discussions go on. But also, there are different forums which provide platform for different countries and alliances to come together and announce different places. These are not legally binding, but this year we have seen mitigation in terms of like reducing global carbon dioxide emissions, but also other greenhouse gases such as methane. So there was this agreement in which countries actually agreed in the text, which is enshrined in this, what we call as Glasgow Climate Pact. So countries have agreed to come again next year with more strengthened emissions targets, emission reductions target. So that was quite an achievement, because initially when Paris Agreement was signed in 2015, the provision was that every 5 years, countries will kind of be more ambitious and present the places which actually does more than what they did like 5 years ago. But at this conference, countries agreed that by next year, they will either update or revise their contributions and make it more ambitious, so that there is as little gap as possible to actually be in line with 1.5 degrees Celsius. Again, this came out of the formal text, out of the formal negotiation, but like I mentioned before, there were also announcements regarding reductions in methane. So a lot of countries actually saw methane reduction as kind of low-hanging fruit, and which gives us more time in order to achieve our goal of the Paris Agreement.
Thank you. So, you know, we clearly like some ambitious goals have been set for next year as well. What's the role of just global South countries, and what can we do in lowering greenhouse gas emissions? Because we are not the highest emitters. However, we do have some emissions and it is important to lower them. So what do you think should be done?
That's really an important question and very relevant to the discussion that I'm interested in. So you very rightly said that we don't see unified voice of countries from South Asia, for example. It may also be because of the fact that at COP, countries usually don't negotiate as individual countries. Rather, they have different alliances or groups with whom they kind of agree and present it as, for example, the G20 proposal from G20, proposal from the least developed countries, et cetera. But we don't have any South Asian forum as such by which countries in the South Asia go there and say that this is exactly what we need or what we propose from South Asia. But talking about Global South, again, countries in the Global South are also in different alliances and different groups. For example, Nepal is in this least developed countries and puts forward an alliance's proposal with what the least developed countries alliance has to say. Personally, I think that our emissions are rising. There is no denial to that. But also seeing the historical responsibility, like you said during your question, that we are not the ones who emitted the major portion, right? I think around 80% of the historical emissions is responsible by the countries in the G20 group. So which means that for countries like ours who want to enjoy all the perks of this development, what does it mean for people who want to have cheap source of electricity, cheap source of energy, but also do not want to be seen as the villains? of this whole climate momentum that is going on. So it's a really crucial question. And along those lines, especially at this COP, India was very much talked about, the country India, because India announced its place to become net zero by 2070. And at the last minute, there was also some discussions around India. Maybe there were also allegations, I would say, that India watered down the language for phasing out coal and making it like a phase down instead of phase out of coal. So again, all these discussions, for all these discussions around what is in the best interest of people, so that of course they want to be the counterpart and in fact the leaders in this momentum and meeting the Paris Agreement, but also not the one who had to bear the burden of something that they did not contribute to, like that was so how to make the fair share of this responsibility so that people who needs all these resources, all these sources of energy also don't have to go through, for example, like financial constraints or go through challenges so that they again like be in this vicious cycle of poverty again and always remain the least developed countries or the developing country and do not have the rights and freedoms as those enjoyed by people, for example, in the global north. So it's a question. I think there is no straight answer to, but again, the discussions are happening, which is a positive sign and the signal that, okay, people are getting more and more conscious about their own rights and freedoms and what their stake is in this whole momentum. So it's a good sign, but again, I don't have a single answer. And I think it has to be seen through multiple lens and be unpackaged so that we can like deal with it, like not in a generic terms, but be more specific of the elements within it.
Completely agree with you that there's no like one single answer or one single theory that can capture the true reality of this issue. However, you did touch on some very key words that set us up for the next question. Like for instance, you talked about just India and you said the word villain as well, you know? So these are some really like important words because like both like Simon and I believe we often discuss that there's such a blame game happening, you know, with climate change. And from our research on COP26, we discovered that like reports have claimed that the summit found its scapegoats in China and also India, like you mentioned, arguing that their responsibility should differ from those of higher emitting nations. So what do you think about this? Like, what do you think about this blame game?
You very rightly said again that there is a lot of blame game going on in every COP, like not just this one. But again, maybe because this COP was seen as very vital, like there was this branding and like very common phrase that this is the last COP for our hope to 1.5, the last COP which will decide our future, et cetera, et cetera. So, because this COP was given so much of importance, I think all these issues and all these terms, individual terms, are getting so much of attention. And regarding India, again, like I said, like quote villains, again, these are the allegations. And from what I see from my personal assessment, I would say that switching away from coal, of course, lies in the best interest of India, not just from climate point of view, but also from health point of view, right? India is a country with over a billion of population. And although coal is a cheap source of energy for millions of people who are in the line of poverty, but also the degrading effect it has, especially on the health of people, like there is no proper evaluation of how much that actually costs, right? If that is compared to what it actually costs to get rid of coal or phase it out completely. So I would say that, of course, phasing out coal lies in the best interest of India, also from the health perspective. But to put all this blame on India, saying that, okay, India is the one who watered down the language around phasing out coal and making it phase down, I think that would not be just, because I was also, again, when I was at COP and also post-COP, I was also reading a lot of articles, interacting with people from India, some in the government, some outside. And this idea, what is fundamental here to understand is The phrase itself is not coined by India, and the origin of this terms phase down instead of phase out can be traced back to other other documents such as, I think, the one in the G20 that was back in October, also in the bilateral document that came out of like US-China China plays, etc. So again, although because this was at the last minute of COP and India publicly put it down, it became very obvious that India was perceived as again the villain in all this blame game. But again, to say that it was done in consensus and was kind of although it was, I do not support the change in the language, but I would say that I wouldn't entirely blame India for that.
One thing that comes to my mind when we talk about coal in India is that when I was doing research, most of the literature was concentrated over the fact that about traditional cooking methods. While you can't really put like the entire blame on these traditional cooking methods, right? But there was a lot of literature just arguing about how women in villages need to change their cooking methods, and that they are also solely responsible for causing a lot of emission. But moving on to the next part of the session. So we did talk about mitigation, but adaptation is important as well. We cannot really fight the climate crisis without adaptation. What were some key points that were brought up about adaptation at the summit?
Sure. Yes, adaptation is very crucial, and especially for countries like ours, which are still in the developing phase. At COP, I think this was a very good news, very well received by people, especially in the developing countries, that there was this pledge to double the adaptation financing by 2025 as compared to the 2019 levels. It was a very encouraging step to recognize adaptation and double the financing adaptation. So that was one of the highlights in terms of adaptation, but also like the general overall outcome of the COP26 in Glasgow.
While talking about adaptation, were there any emphasis put on nature-based solutions for adaptation? Was that something that was brought up during COP26 this year?
Yes. Before the decision comes out, there will be multiple revisions of the text that is proposed, and it just keeps on being revised by parties, but also taking into account what the civil society is saying. So in the initial draft, yes, there was a specific reference to the nature-based solutions. But again, nature-based solutions, well, are so important and has so many benefits also for biodiversity, not just in terms of climate, but also there needs to be caution. And there are certain loopholes which could be easily used by big corporates in the name of nature-based solutions, right? So to the best of my understanding, the language was later revised, and it includes components of nature-based solutions, but does not explicitly like put focus on it. There are mentions about trees and natural resources, biodiversity, but I don't think there is a specific explicit reference to the nature-based solution as a key to solving climate change.
There is cultural importance, right, with like traditional cooking methods using coal. Like Chula has been around for so long. People love the taste of the food there. It's going to be very difficult it's very difficult to like just switch on, like tell them, okay, you need to stop doing this and start using these electric stoves. So I just wanted to ask, were there any like indigenous perspectives, indigenous knowledge that were highlighted in like maybe like adaptation, like for mitigation, but mostly for like adaptation as well?
I mean, not explicitly within the negotiation, but the decision text that came out put a good emphasis on the indigenous knowledge. So it's there, but it does not kind of elaborate on what it means or give the examples. However, besides the main negotiating body, in the different side events that were done at COP26 by different indigenous groups, but also by different not-for-profits, there were sessions which highlighted people from different indigenous communities, how, for example, maybe due to climate change, people from one place, government might take this initiative to system, to relocate them to a new place, but that does not mean that Indigenous people will feel home, and because they have the attachment to the culture, to the land, to their whatever their, for example, whatever that community, that ecosystem offered them in that particular place, right? So there was this huge discussion about the sense of belongingness, what it means for the identity of the Indigenous people. This discussion didn't penetrate the main negotiating halls, also given the technical nature of the session, but outside the main negotiation halls, yes, in the side events, there were a lot of events which focused on different techniques used by Indigenous people, especially in the weather forecasting, for example, also about water resource management, etc. So it was really encouraging to see that at least the side events forum provided these spaces for the Indigenous people. And just to quickly add, I think I missed to say this before, but it's very crucial that I mention it here. We often, when we talk about fossil fuel, like very, very much we focus our attention to coal, and reasonably so, because it's one of the most polluting fossil fuel, the most carbon extensive fossil fuel, which is also so deteriorating for our health. But it is very crucial that we also focus on natural gas and oil, because again, when we talk about fairness, one of India's point was that for this blame game of why India, like at the last minute, changed their mind. One of the responses that I got to hear was because although the convention, again, that I mentioned in the very beginning, that was agreed by in 1990s was to actually limit the use of limit the rise of greenhouse gases. And greenhouse gas emissions is done by coal, but also by oil and natural gas, right? So the emphasis on coal is right, but to kind of bail out oil and natural gas, that didn't sound fair, especially because most of the developed countries rely more on natural gas and oil for their energy mix as compared to countries like India, for whom coal is like predominantly the main energy source. So in a way, I think for this COP26, it was weirdly remarkable that it for the first time directly mentioned phase down of coal. In the previous text and decisions, there was no mention about any kind of fossil fuels, like direct mention of coal, oil, or gas. So at least this is a start, but again, not having oil and natural gas, I think I personally take it as one of the failures of COP26.
Yes, thank you for mentioning that. That was a very important point. And just talking about renewable energy and fossil fuels, I just came to my mind that one of the key terms that I found when I was researching about COP26 was the emphasis put on electric vehicles. And I heard that there were like pledges to transition completely into electric vehicles and things like that. What do you have to say about that?
Yes, that's very right. So again, like I said, beyond the negotiation halls and the decision that came out officially from the COP26 presidency, there were also a lot of like in the range of hundreds of announcements that came from different coalitions, different groups. And one of them was about the transition to electric, like the faster transition to electric vehicles, which I think is great. And I welcome that announcement, that place. But again, because I work with these climate models, and from my understanding, what I can say is, having electric vehicle is great, but what are the source of getting that? What is the source of getting that electricity is really crucial, right? Are we getting the electricity that is needed for electric vehicle from coal, or is it from some renewable? So that is a key question. So unless the decarbonization is there in the energy sector, in the energy mix itself, electric vehicles would help, but would not do significant job until and unless the decarbonization is really there in the energy source.
Narrowing the scope down a little, I just wanted to ask you, there were reports that Nepal is also trying to switch to light electric vehicles by 2031, and they're really promoting this whole electric vehicle situation. What do you think about that? Do you think it's going to be a success in Nepal? Should we put more emphasis on public transport more, or should we really like push this transition?
That's interesting question. In the context of Nepal, I would say, of course, I would want to see more infrastructures being built. It's good to have a commitment, but again, how much of those commitments translate into action is the real point here, right? So without having all the infrastructure, I still doubt that we'll be able to accomplish what we have mentioned in our new commitment, which is to reach net zero by 2045. Nepal actually submitted this, which is a great step, but most of these places and commitments are conditional upon getting enough funding from the developed countries. So it, in a way, Nepal is willing to, but also does not hold itself fully accountable if there is no enough funding and resources to make it happen. And personally, I would also say for Nepal, I think we have more potential, and for the immediate focus, I think we can do much more in promoting cycle-friendly cities as compared to electric vehicle-friendly cities, for example. Of course, I welcome having more electric vehicles, but again, our cities, our communities are more designed through our indigenous knowledge and through our historic, all what our ancestors have kind of thought and planned was more to make it cycle friendly, pedestrian friendly. So I think we have a real advantage there. So sometimes when you think of too much in advance and try to kind of replicate whatever is going on in the developed countries, it is very obvious that we might forget what we already have and what we can already do. So I think promoting cycle-friendly and pedestrian-friendly cities is low-hanging fruit as compared to promoting electric vehicles. But nevertheless, I would love the idea and seeing the infrastructures built for electric vehicles in Nepal.
Thank you for saying that. I think Simon and I, we really appreciate that. But, to kind of taking a step back, so earlier we're talking about indigenous knowledge, and I think that it is very important for us to ask you in particular this question, because you are a woman from a global South country who represented the country and also your personal work at this international summit. It's often ignored, I would say, and not acknowledged that women often, like indigenous people, women bear the brunt of the climate crisis. And there were some reports that we read that women were still missing at the top climate table at COP26. So we'd really love to hear from you your perspective on this. What was it like at COP26, and how did you feel personally?
Sure, thank you for asking that question. I think the answer lies very deep in my heart to this question. I have been working on climate change since 2014, so it's been nearly 8 years. And I work especially, like I mentioned before, with climate models, interactive climate tools, more on the interface of science and policy. And I can honestly and very brutally say that there have been several incidents where I had been tokenized and I was just put at the table because I was a young woman from Nepal, not many young women were there. So again, I see that not just in Nepal, but talking about global South and even in many cases in the global North, actually people in the power of decision making are opening up spaces for women, especially young women. But are those spaces really meant to provide decision making power or to have a real voice? Or are those platforms and spaces being there just because everyone is talking about that, just because everyone is now talking about inclusion, participation, and whatnot? So I think for me, I have observed the change in the narrative about how young women should be involved in all this process. And also I've seen countless of incidents where young women especially are, despite having their leadership potential, despite seeing all the relevant facts and points and sharing their stories, but also sharing and leading in science and technology, are not taken seriously. I mean, if I was there with my, for example, another male counterpart, and we both were talking about science, it is very likely that the person who is man will be taken more seriously than what I have to say, for example, and not just in case of Nepal, in many different countries, even the developed countries, we have seen this. So again, this is very traumatic in a way, but also I feel hopeful that at least the discussion is kind of emerging now. People are being more vocal and not waiting for anyone else to grant them their spaces. People, for example, I demand my own space. I don't wait for someone to create space for me. So I think this kind of climate consciousness and also consciousness about one's own right, one's own freedom, and what lies there for me, what is at stake for me as a young woman or women in general. I think this kind of consciousness has really spurred in the, especially in the past 3 or 4 years, which is a very good signal. And although we don't have enough leadership from women in the decision-making tables, I see the scenario changing gradually, not at the speed I would ideally like, but yeah, change is inevitable, I would say. So we are getting there. We just need to have more people in the board.
Much for saying that, because like this is, like you said, like it's a very personal like the answer to the question was very personal to you. And I can truly say that, you know, seeing like women like you from our country, it's so inspiring, you know, for people like us. Like, we did not know each other before today, but you're definitely creating such an impact and inspiring us, so really thankful for that.
And I am equally thankful for you two for creating this platform to amplify the voices. I think it's this kind of collaboration between us, between young women and women in general in Nepal, in South Asia. I think there is a lot we can do on ourselves. But again, the collaboration could be a big challenge. And oftentimes, because even within the climate movement, people have their own agendas, people have their own interests. So how to kind of make everything, see everything from more holistic approach and know and be convinced that overall, at the end of the day, all of us want the same thing, that is inclusive participation, and also making sure that we will be able to limit as much as possible the dangerous impacts of climate change, right? So despite all our interests, despite our capabilities in different things and interest in maybe different parts of climate movement, I think platforms like this, for example, podcasts like this is one example. A storytelling platform could be another. Collaboration in scientific papers could be the next one. Campaigning across different countries, which is led by young women, could be another. These are, again, happening, but again, we need to accelerate it, I think. So I'm equally thankful to both of you for having me and also creating this podcast platform.
Sometimes I just feel like the language that's being used often like can be very demotivating for women who want to make change.
And I would very quickly add to that. For example, if I get a seat in the table in the negotiation or in the side event, I would like to be seen as women who has knowledge in science, not just because I come from Nepal or belong to the group, which is comes from the least developed countries, right? So how to move this narrative from being the victim to being also the leaders, like having potential to do in science, technology, or indigenous knowledge, whatever it may be. Like, so how we see that framing, I think would also be a key if we are to achieve what we really want.
Totally agree with you. Like, tokenism is so prevalent. And also another thing is representation is not enough. Like, that is, you know, it's hyped up. It's important, but it's not enough. Like, we need to be appreciated for who we are, like our talents, not just because we, you know, we are from Nepal. So yeah, totally agree with you. But I think we're gonna now kind of change the focus. And COVID-19 has definitely really impacted the climate crisis on different levels as well. So it might be a bit of a vague question because it's very complex in true nature. So COP26 during a pandemic, what do you think? What do you think was the challenges, and what do you what do you have to say about this?
Yeah, like you said, it's a complex question, but I think COVID-19 added further complexity to the already existing complexities around COP, the process of COP, right? And the issue about vaccine inequality, kind of restricting or preventing people who did not have like both the vaccinations that is required or the complete dose of vaccination that was required, were not able to access. All those, the UNFCCC made provisions to provide, for example, vaccines to people who were given the badges to attend COP, but those vaccines did not reach out to everyone in time. And again, with the process and the time that takes to process visa, find accommodation in a country, with all the challenges, even after all the challenges, it was surprising for me to read that COP26 is the COP to have the highest number of registered participants at COP, like till, like in all its history. But again, those were the number of registered people, right? Around 40,000 people registered. I don't think we have official count yet of how many actually attended. It should be somewhat lesser than the number of people who registered. And with COVID-19 in place, there was a huge discussion going on before COP, like whether it was the right decision to gather so many thousands of people. Can it be a next hotspots for like the next wave of COVID-19? So there were even some calls about postponing the COP. But I think at least from what we saw at the meeting, which was held in the early half of 2021, the online version, for parties to come and kind of discuss, it was not very successful when things were done online. So in a way, I think it was the right step. Like, although there was so much of caution and cautiousness in place to make sure that safety protocols are met and it does not become the next, like the breeding farm for coronavirus, etc. But nevertheless, inside the COP venue, I think due to COVID-19, a lot of restrictions were imposed, especially for civil society to access the main negotiating halls. So for people who were not official representatives of government, they had real hard time to go there inside the negotiating hall and observe by themselves in person, like what the discussions looked like. So again, there were so many complications right from the process of like getting the vaccines to applying for a visa to quarantine, this issue about quarantine. And even after like coming through like all the challenges and making it to COP26, inside the venue also there were so many restrictions which kind of limited meaningful and fair participation, especially of the civil society. So yeah, COVID-19 definitely added to the already existing complexities within the COP.
One very interesting conversation that I had found on Twitter was that COP26 this year was one of the highest emitting United Nations environmental summit so far. And there was a number put into it as well. And it said that, I think this was on the Washington Post, that said that 102,500 tons of carbon dioxide equivalents. The summit was responsible for that much of emission, which is actually almost twice as much during the Madrid summit in 2019. So there was this whole thread going on about why couldn't this have been done on Zoom if we really did want to prevent prevent greenhouse emission. So what do you think about that? Do you think something like this could be done over Zoom, or what is the future of summits like this?
Well, yeah, this is another interesting question. Again, a lot of debates and all these points about whether Zoom would be advantageous versus in-person have their own merits and demerits. But at least for this COP, I would again reiterate what I just said. I think it was the right decision to have it in person because the main reason here being what happens inside the negotiating halls is the outcome of what the parties discuss, but also a lot of it is shaped by the pressure that the civil society and other people in the side events who are kind of mobilizing, doing all these events, protesting outside the hall. So all these voices, when unified, I think that puts an extra pressure to the decision makers and make them more accountable to hold on what they had said like in 2015 or before that. And this kind of like momentum that you feel when it is in person is can't of course be compared to when it is in Zoom. And also again with the online, of course the emissions would have been lower as compared to when it's in person, but again given that delegates will be situated in different time zones, and again the internet connection may not be smooth for everyone, again there are other logistical challenges, right, and that needs to be figured out. So all it also has some of its like own demerits. But having said that, I would say this question has been raised a couple of times before as well. Like, how many COPs do we actually need? Because we know what we need to do, right? Countries know what they need to do. People in different sectors, civil society know what they need to do, what their roles are. But do we actually need like COP annually to reiterate what we basically already know like decades ago? So this question has been out there for quite some time now, not in a majority of population within the COP, but within some people who think and really takes into account of all the emissions and all actually resources and infrastructures that goes into play when COP is organized in one particular city. So again, these are ongoing decisions. I think at this point, we can think of how to make it more cleaner and greener instead of, because up until 2030, I think it will be really crucial for us to like rapidly cut down our emissions and make it sustained and hold everyone accountable. And at least until that point, I personally see that having in-person discussions really spurs that momentum and holds everyone like in this by the same thread and make everyone looking forward and like kind of puts pressure on someone who does not want to come in the town. So at least until 2030, I see that necessary.
Yes, I definitely agree with you. That's why it's so important for civil society organizations, for climate activists, for Indigenous community members to be present at COP, because they're the ones who can really put pressure on global leaders.
Well, like you said, like climate activists and advocates, they're so important, you know, yet like sometimes it's so hard for like all these newspaper articles, like cover them and stuff like that. And I know during this COP26, like celebrities also jumped in to like promote like activists. And I clearly remember Shawn Mendes giving his Instagram account to a climate activist so that, you know, she could cover what's happening in COP26. So maybe that is something we should see like happening more, right?
Yeah, again, I would say like activism just by itself may not have all the power, but activism of course has a great role in shaping how the discussion and discourse on the climate change goes forward, right? So again, I would say that activism needs to be paired with like what needs to be done actually in terms of implementation, and not just kind of saying that this is not right, this is not right, you are doing it wrong, just kind of putting more blames and just kind of thinking that we are the victims, you have done it all wrong. I think just switching away from that narrative would be required as we move forward. But nevertheless, the activism has been, especially in the last 3 or 4 years, have been successful in shaping a lot of outcomes, climate outcomes. As I'm working on science and policy, I also see that activism, of course, we also need to think of way in which we kind of organize ourselves as activists. But that maybe that discussion is for some next time. But yeah, activism definitely has a role to play.
This has been such an insightful conversation, and I feel like we can go on and on about this, but we do have to end this episode, and we want to do this by asking you one last question. So what next step do you expect to see from the global leaders after the summit?
Yeah, I think the next step I would like to see from global leaders is COP26 kind of didn't actually ensure that we'll be at 1.5 degrees Celsius by the, we'll limit the temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. It didn't ensure that, but what it ensured or kept the hope alive is at least we are on the right track. Like we still have some time, we still have some chance to make that happen. So I would say that instead of kind of making places for like far away in the future, like 2050, 2070, we'll do this, we'll do that. What we really need at now is deep and sustained reductions in fossil fuel consumption, like moving away from all these polluting energy sources to clean energy sources in the near term. Like, again, it's good to have like long-term strategy, but putting more focus on what we don't know, like in 30 years or 20 years from now, is, I think, not a wise step for us, given the time that we have, the short time we have to actually make sure that we are able to deliver on what we really thought of when we sent in the Paris Agreement. So my only thought, my only hope, and my only work, I think, would be concentrated more on how to make sure that in the near term, we are committed to getting rid of fossil fuels, not just coal, but also oil and natural gas, and how to look for other alternatives and boost them.
That was great. Thank you so much, Ms. Bhandari, for joining us today. And we are so grateful to have connected with you, and we've learned so much from you, and we cannot wait to see all that you accomplish in the coming years. Thank you.
I'm so thankful to you too as well. It's been such a great honor to have this discussion, organic discussion, I would say. And thank you for having me in this show, and I really enjoyed having this insightful discussion with both of you today.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to our episode. You can listen to our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Anchor, and other platforms. You can also find us on YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Links to these platforms will be in the description box.
We'll also attach reference links and news articles in the description box below. See you next month. Thank you.